Hi, I'm Wendy. This is Wendy's Coffee House. I've interviewed guests before who've been able to show proof of their past lives, reincarnation. What happens when you don't believe it, when you're a skeptic, when this doesn't even register on your radar? And then you find out, through a fluke, that you might have had a past life. Not only might have had, but you can connect the dots that what you experience in a past life regression actually adds up to real life reality. Robert Snow.
And it's funny, when I got on to number one, something really bizarre happened. All of a sudden, I wasn't imagining I was in a valley. I wasn't just thinking of a daydream. I was in a valley. It was as crystal clear as any other vision. I was walking along this full path in the valley, and I could see the veins and the leaves next to me. I could feel a breeze in my face. I figured the breeze was just the air conditioning. Now, I knew what happened. I wasn't real stupid. I knew that I'd obviously been hypnotized, that this was just the hypnosis working on me. But it was kind of fascinating because it was just the amazing clarity of it.
Robert served 38 years with the Indianapolis Police Department, retiring in 2007 as captain. 20-some books on Amazon. This is part one. And the second part, paranormal stuff that he dealt with while he was on the police force. Two parts, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, the true story of a police detective's reincarnation. Start where you feel comfortable.
As I said, I was a police officer for 38 years at the Indianapolis Police Department, and I was a captain for 22 of those years. But really, growing up, I never thought about being a policeman. I never wanted to be one. Never occurred to me to even be one. The only thing I've always wanted to be from my earliest memories was a writer. When I was 5 or 6, people asked, what do you want to be when you grew up? I said, I want to be a writer. And they, of course, they pat you on the head and say, well, that's nice. Like saying you want to be president to most people. Say, oh, that's nice. Let it go. But I always have. Always wanted to be a writer. But I was in the military during the Vietnam War, and I did my 4 years. When I got out, I all of a sudden need a job. I'm recent discharge, need a job. My brother had just joined the police department a year or so before that. So he said, hey, they're needing guys real bad. Everybody's over and still over in Vietnam. Come down and apply. It's a pretty good job, pays well. So I did, and so stayed there 38 years. And actually, it's very fortuitous because police work, number one, it's a good job, good pay, good benefits, but also gave me tons and tons of material for writing. You just got more material than you can really use. So I became a professional writer. But the thing about being a writer is you just can't be a writer. You also have to be a reader. And you have to read not just from your select field of ideas. I did all my books about law enforcement. But you have to read from other fields, see how someone handles things. You know, if somebody handles a passage really well, you want to kind of break it apart and see what they did. And if you see a passage really terrible, you want to make sure you don't do what they did. So I read from all different fields. I used to belong to a lot of book clubs. Well, one time I got a book club circular. It said they had a book called Coming Back by a Dr. Raymond Moody. And it was both Dr. Moody had done some research into near-death experiences, and he had a friend who was a psychologist who did past life regression therapy, and she kind of talked him into doing a past life regression. So he did it, and he talks about it in his book, and he went back to 8 different past lives, and it was a very real whirlwind book, really interesting. But when he got to the end of the book, he kind of said, I don't know, this might just be my imagination. He wasn't convinced they were really past lives. And that's how I felt about the subject. I thought, this is just people with wishful thinking, people who want to think that just because this life is terrible, it's not my fault. It's another past life's fault, not mine. So I always felt that reincarnation was kind of a belief. People with weak people who just want to blame their troubles on something else. So I forgot about the book pretty much and went on to other books. Well, a few months later, I was at a party. And I was talking to a lady, Kathy Graben. Kathy Graben was a police detective, but also a practicing psychologist. So we were making a little small talk about, movies we'd seen, what have you. Got around the books we'd read. And I remembered this book, and I told her I'd read this book. And she asked me what I thought about it. And it's kind of late in the party, and I had a bit to drink, and I was basically making fun of it. I didn't realize at the time that Kathy used for past life regression therapy in her practice. I was just kind of making fun of it, how silly I thought it was, what a stupid idea it was. So she basically got on the point. She said, well, you think so stupid, why don't you try it? She kind of, I said, nah, I'm not going to do that. She said, oh, you're scared. Now, you don't want to ask a man if he's scared. Of course, you're going to say no. And And basically got down to the point, she finally said, well, if you're not scared, try it yourself. And finally, just to shut her up, I said I would. So she gave me a card with the name of a psychologist who practiced it. So for the next day, you're much more sober and clear headed and everything. I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm stupid. I'm not going to do it. So I just basically just forgot about it. But it seemed like from then on, I would run to Kathy all the time. You'd see her and she'd say, have you made the appointment yet? And I'd come up with some weak excuse, but no, I had two meetings and so much to do and I couldn't do it. But it's funny because before this, I'd maybe run to Kathy once every 2 months or so. But see, Mike, after this, I run to her every day. I'd see her, I'd try and get away. I thought, oh my God, there she's down the hallway. I'm thinking, because after a while, your excuses really sound feeble. So I'm wanting to go the other way. Well, it got to the point where I thought, oh, this is fool. This is stupid. So I just finally asked her, I finally called the lady. It was a Dr. Mary Ellen Griffith, the name she gave me. I finally called her and made an appointment. I thought, I'm just going to get this done. I don't have to go hiding from her anymore. So, but I decided also what I was going to do. I was going to bring my own tape recorder along. I was going to record it. And then I was going to show Kathy how stupid it was. I say, but at the time, I believed I was too strong-willed. I didn't think I could be hypnotized. And even if I was, I just didn't believe there was any such thing as past life. I was just a bunch of fooey. I'll go there. I'll cooperate 100% with whatever the Dr. Griffith asked me to do. I'll do it. And I'll show Kathy how stupid the whole thing is. So I went and sat down and talked and met Dr. Griffith, and she was a very nice lady, very nice. And she asked me why I was there, and I told her I just thought that past life's regression was interesting. I wanted to try it. So she had no problem with that. So anyway, we just started talking. And finally, after a while, I said, okay, you're ready to start. So I'm sitting on this couch in her office, and she said, okay, now close your eyes. Can you see a balloon? Now, I was sitting on the couch, and the light was coming in from the window to my right. And you could see a dot on your mind, a blob on your eye, a purple blob. But I knew it was just sunlight coming in. But I told her, yeah, I can see a purple balloon. She said, okay. She said, now we're going to get in this balloon, and we're going to take it up. So I want you to just imagine that. So I imagine me getting the balloon, taking it up. So we can take the balloon up. And here's enough. But by my eyelids, I could see little points of light. But I figured at that time it was just reflection off the floor. I didn't think too much about it. So anyway, she said, okay, now we're in the balloon. I want you to take it down. She said, there's a control up ahead. And in mind, imagine reaching up and pulling the control, bring the balloon down. So, okay. We did this probably 12 to 15 times. And nothing happened. And I was thinking to myself, this is what it is. This is stupid. There's nothing happening. Absolutely nothing happened. She said, pull the balloon down. I'd imagine pulling. She said, where'd you land? I said, nowhere. I mean, nothing happened. And I figured, well, the problem is, this is her daydream, not mine. So anyway, she didn't seem to get flustered or anything. So finally says, okay, see if you can imagine a mountain in your mind. Okay, so I imagine a mountain in my mind. She said, okay. She says, now, I want you to take the balloon over to the mountain. Well, interesting enough, I don't know if I was just I was tired or trying to do what she asked me to do. But finally, I could see myself laying a balloon. But again, it was not clear thought, or it was just kind of imagination, laying myself on a mountain. She said, okay, what do you see? She said, interesting enough, I could see a log cabin. But it wasn't real clear or anything. It was kind of like, again, like a imagination daydream type thing. But the interesting part was the logs were going vertically rather than horizontally. One of my writers later wrote to me and told me that was the French method for building log cabins. So anyways, Dr. Griffith said, go into the cabin. What do you see? Well, I didn't see anything. Again, this is her daydream. I said, nothing. She said, imagine a meal. And okay, imagine enjoying the meal and so forth. I'm trying to do everything she says. That was my plan, to do everything she says, like so how foolish this was. So she finally said, the meal's over. She said, okay, she's now, there. You're going to come out of the cabin. There's 12 steps walking down to the valley. I want you to walk down the stairs, and I'll count as you walk down. So I start walking down. So, start to imagine in my mind walking down some stairs. And she starts counting. She goes, 12. And it's funny, each number got longer, 11, 10, 9. And I just think to myself, silly this all was. Really silly and foolish this was. But anyway, she counts. And it's funny, when I got on to number one, something really bizarre happened. All of a sudden, I wasn't imagining I was in a valley. I wasn't just thinking of a daydream. I was in a valley. It was as crystal clear as any other vision. I was walking along this little path in the valley, and I could pick up, I could see the veins in the leaves next to me. I could feel a breeze in my face. I figured the breeze was just the air conditioning. Now, I knew what happened. I wasn't real stupid. I knew that I'd obviously been hypnotized, that this was just the hypnosis working on me. But it was kind of fascinating because it was just the amazing clarity of it. I could see every, I could see all every leaf and every tree. I could, like I said, if I look close up, I could see the veins in the leaves. And she said, okay. She says, Mitchell, walk along. She says, describe, look down, describe yourself. So I looked down, and I could see a bunch of hairy legs and dirty feet. And I was wearing fur in my left hand. I had to look like a piece of a big tree limb. Now, everybody, you know, everybody has seen movies and TV programs about cavemen. You have, you know what it is. And I thought, boy, you know, again, I'm thinking just the hypnosis, just bringing up something I've seen on TV. Now, it was kind of funny. I was really, it was just kind of like you can go to Disney World, other amusement parks. You can get on a virtual reality ride, and it looks really real. I mean, it looks real to you, but it's not. And that's what this, I thought this one, this is just a hypnosis, bring up old memories of movies or TV or something like that. But it's written and reorder them into a story. But it was, but to me, it was fascinating, only because of how clear it was. And I was really enjoying this because, again, it was like the coolest ride you'd ever been on, even though you knew it wasn't true. But then suddenly, all of a sudden, I could see what the person's body I was having, I could see what he was thinking. And he was, and it was like I was two separate parts of my mind. I knew what Bob Snow was thinking, but I also knew what this person was thinking. And I heard, and all of a sudden I started talking without knowing I was going to talk. Usually when you say something, you got a few half seconds or so to think what you're going to say before you say it. In this case, I didn't. I just blurted out. I said, "This is where I live. I live in a cave up on the hill." And I was kind of stunned because I didn't know I was going to say that. So she said, "Okay." Says, go to your cave, go up to your home. Now, I didn't have to walk up there. It was just a split second. And I was staying in front door of the cave, staying looking at the cave. Then really something really kind of amazing, kind of almost halfway frightening, scary, is when I walked in a cave, I could smell that whoever was there wasn't very hygienic. The cave just reeked. It was really, just smelled really bad. And I couldn't figure where that was coming from. And then I figured this hypnosis just really got me in deep. So anyway, we talk about this and everything. She said, okay, I want you to go to your death. Go to your death. And for this and this. I said, okay. So, and what happened, and you'd have, I'd have maybe 3 or 4 or 5 seconds of just fog, gray fog. Then it come back into focus. When it came back, I was up, I wasn't in the body anymore. I was floating above. And I could see a skinny little man laying on the cave floor with fur on. He was just coughing and hacking and shivering. I knew that was me. That was me, and I was dying. And so Dr. Griffith said, okay, what did you learn from this life? And again, before I knew I was going to say anything, I just blurted out. I had to learn what it's like to be totally alone. I had nobody in this life. I was totally alone my whole life. She said, okay. She said, now go, you see a light with a valley. And I looked up and turned up. There's a real bright light with a valley. She said, I want you to go into the light and go to a life when you did have someone, when you had someone close. So I'm, this is, again, this is fun. This is, again, like a neatest ride I've ever been on in my life. So I go into the light. And again, so again, there's 4 or 5 seconds of just gray fog. You can't see anything. When I come out, it was sort of like, you know, people probably don't remember this anymore, but older people remember you used to go to the movies sometimes, and the movie would be all blurry for a second, then snap into clarity. Well, that's what this was. I came out of the gray fog, and everything was kind of blurry. But then it snapped back into focus. I looked around. Dr. Griff said, where are you at? I said, I'm on a city street. She said, you know what year it is. And I didn't know what year it was, but I could see there were horse-drawn carriages and gas lights. But I was in a big city with tall buildings around me. So I figured probably the middle to late 1800s. She said, okay, describe yourself. So I looked down and I described myself as well-dressed. And I had a walking cane. She said, what are you doing? What are you going to do? I said, I'm meeting a woman. She said, okay. She said, go ahead and meet the woman. Now what happens? I said, I meet a woman in a red dress, and we go to an outdoor cafe, and I ordered a glass of wine, she ordered some kind of special water. So we went through this scene for a bit, and Dr. Griff said, okay, I want you to go 5 years in the future. So I went 5 years in the future, and again, it was a gray fog for 5 seconds. And also, I'm in the hallway of the look like apartment building, and I'm having a really vigorous argument with a woman who I told Dr. Griff I thought was my wife. We were arguing, we had a really serious argument, so I just turned and walked away. I walked down the hallway into a room, And I could see it was an artist studio. It was a long room, the whole roof of skylights, and there was a wall of windows, the whole wall of windows at the right. The room was filled with dozens of paintings, dozens of things. Then again, as with the caveman, I can suddenly understand, I understand you knew what this person was thinking. I knew I was an artist. This is how I make my living, doing art. She said, Doctor, that's how I describe it, all dark roof again. And she said, okay. She said, now go 5 years in the future. So I go 5 years in the future, and I'm starting at a party. And I'm not sure what this party is all about, but I'm the biggest honor because everybody's congratulating me and shaking my hand, telling me, oh, congratulations. I had no idea what it was for. But I could feel this person, what this person invited him, what he felt. It was a moment of really intense happiness. I mean, he was just like, this one of the happiest moments of his life. Now, again, I'm not sure what he did to accomplish this, but he was the guy, like I said, the guest of honor, and he was just extraordinarily happy. So Dr. Griffiths, I described it to her. Dr. said, go 5 years in the future. But I didn't. I stayed there for a while because you think about how often in your life do you ever get this sense of real happiness? I mean, maybe that your wedding or your first child or so, but you don't have that often in your life. And it really felt good to be there. And I stayed for it. Dr. Griffith had told me about three times. Said, go 5 years. And that's the interesting thing. People seem to think under hypnosis, they've seen too many things on TV and the movies, how they, you know, the hypnotist makes you cluck like a chicken and all this. That's not really so. You're in hypnosis. You're still in control. You know what's going on. You're just tapping your subconscious mind, but you're still in control. So anyway, Dr. Griffith, finally, he said, go 5 years. So, okay. So I did. And I went to, I found myself in a rare, huge, huge garden. And I was painting in a huge, huge garden. So I described this to Dr. Griffith. She said, okay. So now I want you to go to your death. She said, go to your death and tell me what happens. Okay. So I see myself laying on a bed, and I died. And then all of a sudden I pass. I see my ghost or like my spirit raised on my body. Everybody's seen movies and TV. I knew where this came from when I was under hypnosis. I said, this is just a movie I've seen. You die, your ghost comes out of your body. I go past somebody. I go up through the ceiling of this apartment I was in. And I saw, all of a sudden, I see over a huge city. It's nighttime and over a huge city. The city just, there was lights in every direction I looked. There were lights. It was over a huge city. And I could tell it wasn't winter, but it looked like a late fall. It looked like a mushy day because Dr. Griffiths told me, he said, okay, now, what did you regret about this life? I said, I regret we didn't have children. We didn't have children because my wife couldn't have children. She said, okay. She said, I want you to go into the light. But again, I didn't do what she said. I saw myself flying through some woods. I could tell, like I said, it was kind of mid to late fall because it was a blustery night, but kind of a cold blustery night. But the trees all still had their leaves on. So in that few moments, I find myself, I'm on the second or third floor of a mansion. I'm looking in the window. And it's a room with a big roaring fire in the fireplace. Nobody's in the room, but over the fireplace is one of my paintings. I told Dr. Griffith, I wanted to see one of my paintings before I went on. I wanted to stop seeing one of my paintings. Finally, she said, okay. She said, I want you now, go to a life and you're a female. And I just kind of laughed myself. I thought, yeah, that's going to happen. But so again, there was like 4 or 5 seconds of gray fog. And all of a sudden, I'm in another body. I look down and I can see I'm in a woman's body. Now, this kind of flustered me because, I mean, where's this subconscious memory going to come from?
Robert Snow, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, The True Story of a Police Detective's Reincarnation. And we're going to take a quick break. Wendy's Coffee House. Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, The True Story of a Police Detective's Reincarnation. Robert Snow.
I thought, this has to be some movie I've seen, something. This has to be something funny. So she asked me where I'm at. I was in a woods, like a wooded area. And I was looking, I was standing looking, just looked like there was some kind of Greek, not a building, but a big altar in a circle with pillars. I described all to Dr. Griffith. And I tell her, I said, I work here. Again, I can see what I know what this person's thinking. I said, me and some other girls, we work here breaking things down to the altar. She's asked me, says, where you at? And before I could even think or say anything, I said, I'm in Greece. And I had no idea why I said that. I had no idea where I was at. But anyway, she asked about my job. I said, you have to be a young girl, you have to be pretty, you have to be a virgin to work here. She said, okay. She said, now go 5 years in the future. So like I have 5 years in the future, and all of a sudden I see myself I'm in a wagon being driven by oxen, and there's an old man sitting to the left of me. To the right, there's a little girl, and which I immediately knew was my little girl. So what had happened? Apparently, I was obviously wasn't a virgin any longer, and I wasn't qualified for the job, and they either sold me or gave me to the old man. But anyway, the little girl sitting next to me, I recognized her as someone from my present life. It was my daughter, my stepdaughter, but it wasn't the age she was at the time I had the regression. She was a teenager in high school. She was the age it was when I married her mother. Just a little blonde girl there. I thought, dang, that's my stepdaughter. But again, I'm still thinking this is wild. This is neat and wild. But again, this is just my memories. So anyway, we get to the farm and the old man dies. For he dies pretty soon after we get there. And so what I do with my daughter is I take her back to the altar and I give them to her. And I'm trying to tell mine. It's funny because I can know what this person's body is thinking. And I know this person realizes that I'm not really being kind or good to my daughter. I keep telling them it was a good thing to do because she'd be fed and taken care of over there. And so I was really doing her a favor leaving her. But what I felt instead was a tremendous guilt. I felt this awful, awful, heavy guilt. I knew what I was doing is abandoning her because it'd be a lot easier for me to move along without a little girl tagging along with me. So anyway, I'm just feeling this awful guilt. And Dr. Griffith said, okay, just now go to your death. So what apparently I had moved on to some fishing village. So I saw myself in the water, and I could feel I had nets, like fishing nets, caught around my legs, and I was drowning. And interesting, for a few moments, I could taste salt water. And again, I thought how really bizarre this was. But finally, after I talked to Dr. Griffith about everything, and I still had this awful guilt, she said, okay, so now I want you to go into the life you lived before you were Bob Snow. Go into your most recent past life. Believe me, I was glad to go into life this time. I mean, the guilt, I felt like there was a bricks on my chest from the guilt of this thing. And I kept thinking to myself, how silly is this, Bob? How foolish and silly is this? There's no guilt. This is not real. But I was really glad to go into life. So I went to light, and about 4 or 5 seconds later, all of a sudden I find myself, I'm back in the painter's body. And I'm painting a portrait at that time. But interesting enough, it was the portrait of a hunchback woman. And I'm thinking, now where could I have seen this at in my past, in my life? Where could this come from? What memory could this have come from? But interesting, as I'm painting, I could see every brush stroke. That's how clear the regression was. I could see every brush stroke in this painting. And I could see I was just about finished. I say, Dr. Griffith, I don't like painting portraits. I hate painting portraits, but I need the money. And I could feel this person felt. The person felt this desperate need for money. I kept saying, I don't like painting portraits, but I have to. So Dr. Griffith, I said, okay. So go 5 years ahead. So I went 5 years ahead. The next thing, I'm having a real vigorous argument with someone about poor paint, about poor lighting on one of my paintings. I'm painting my painting as being exhibited, but I thought there was poor lighting for it. I'm having this real vigorous argument. And so we talked about that for a while. She said, okay. So go 5 years ahead. So I go 5 years ahead, and I'm standing in a small garden. And I look, and there's a house real up in the hills, just real close to it. So I walk into the house, and my wife's there playing the piano for people standing around. So I describe everything to her. She said, okay, go 5 years ahead. So during the gray fog in between the scenes, all of a sudden I blurred out, she died of a blood clot. The doctor said she died of a blood clot. Now, I had no idea who this person is talking about, other than he felt tremendous grief and sadness over this. And I almost felt like I wanted to cry. I don't know who the person was, but obviously it was a woman who was very, very important to this man. But I didn't know what the time it was. Then, before I could get to the next five-year thing, my recorder, I go along, snapped off, opened my eyes, and that was over. And now, I'm really feeling kind of flustered, because I came here thinking absolutely nothing's going to happen. Zero. And all of a sudden, I had this really extremely vivid regression. I didn't really think it was regression at the time, but it's really a very, very vivid hypnosis.
And it's all on tape, right? It's all on tape.
Yeah. It's all on tape. Yeah. and I just felt, I didn't know what to do at the moment, only because I hadn't expected this at all. I still didn't believe it was anything real in my subconscious mind, but I hadn't expected that kind of clarity. So anyway, Dr. Griffith asked me, he said, do you see how this relationship is in life? And I really couldn't at the moment. I just kind of flushed and finally got out of there. And I went and sat in my car. I sat in my car for maybe a half hour trying to think about this. and I'm trying to, you know, figure out where could this have come from. Where, I mean, these are not memories I can remember. Nothing of this thing is anything I can remember happening. How, you know, where did this all come from? And as a funny thing, for the first couple of years after regression, if I closed my eyes, I could still see every scene just as clear. I could see every, if I imagine myself painting a portrait, I could still see every brush stroke in the portrait. And I'd close my eyes and I could still see it. It really bugged me. I thought, what the hell's going on? What was this? But then finally I said, Bob, this is just the hypnosis playing tricks. Let it go. I said, just let it go. Don't worry about it. That sounds good. But I really couldn't. Weeks and weeks, I'd think about it 50 times a day. I'd close my eyes and see it again and think about it. And it really started bugging me because I couldn't stop thinking about it. I'd dream about it and think about it constantly. And it got me worried because I could see I was becoming obsessed. And believe me, as a police officer, I have seen a lot of people obsessed. And when you have a serious obsession, it really doesn't always turn out real well for you. And I knew I needed to do something about this because I simply could not stop thinking about it. For weeks, I could not think. Also, I could think about. So I said, what I need to do, I need to find one of the two paintings, the Hunchback Woman painting or the painting I'd seen with the fireplace. It was a still life. It had fruit and bottle and a big sun in the background. I thought, well, if I could find one of these two paintings, explain everything. Because all of a sudden, I remember, oh, yeah, I saw this at an exhibition somewhere, and they had a little bio of the artist, and that's where it all come from. I thought, that would be easy. That's what I thought. So I made a plan. I would go to the library. Now, this happened during pre-internet days. So you just couldn't go and put, you know, Hunchback painting in a search engine and find this happened before the internet came around. And so in those days, when you wanted to do research, you went to the library and pulled books off the shelf. And that was what I planned to do. I'd go to the library, go to their art section, and start hunting through books. I figured they had to be at least semi-famous paintings, or I would never have known about them. I'm not an art aficionado. I don't know that much about art. Really don't. So I figured I would paintings explain all that I'd remember. And then all this would just be a hypnosis, just bring up old memories, you know, and reorder them to make a good story. So anyway, but the problem was I didn't realize how many art books the Napa Public Library had hundreds of them. But I spent several months and I went through every single one, every single art book. Didn't find either painting. So that kind of bugged me. I thought, gee, it should be here. So what I did, I started going around to bookstores. And I thought, you know, B. Dalton and that. Of course, I don't think they're around anymore, but they were then. And very Barnes & Noble. And I started looking at their art books. Figured they have something within the library. I still didn't find any. Still didn't find them. So I thought, you know, I couldn't. I thought, God, they had to be. They have to be here somewhere. So I even called around several galleries and other things and described the paintings to them. And asked if they knew about them, they existed, and where, you know, where they were. But I found something interesting. In pre-internet days, there was no listing of paintings anywhere. You had to know. Now, if you wanted a Van Gogh or a Rembrandt or something, of course you could find out. Everybody were there. But lesser paintings, you had to basically know where it was. You had or knew somebody who might have known where it's at, because otherwise you couldn't find it. So I was kind of flustered there. I even went back to Dr. Griffith for a second session, hoping we could pull up the R's again, maybe get a little more information so I could figure out where I knew about him from this life. But interesting enough, during that regression, I went back to old three or four past lives, but every time she tried to get me to the artist's life, nothing would happen. It was nothing. It's just zip. I could go back to other past lives, but nothing happened with the artist. And Dr. Griffith told me, well, you know everything you need to know. At the time, I didn't realize I did. But at the time, I thought, shit, no, I don't. I don't know nothing. I don't know anything. So anyway, I finally decided, well, boy, maybe you need to find out what happened during regression. So I went to a New Age store in Indianapolis and got a couple of books on the past life regression. And maybe I could read up and see what happened. And in a couple of the books, I saw they had a kind of like a dialogue thing for self-hypnosis. And it looked very similar to Dr. Griffith's, where she asked you to imagine a lot of things and visualize them, describe them. I thought, maybe I could try that. And believe me, I found out something. Self-hypnosis is a lot harder than you think it is. It was really a lot of, I did it probably a dozen times. And only twice I could feel myself going into the same state I was in Dr. Griffith's office. And I see myself going into it. But then it only lasts, two or three seconds. I'd see the number one, then be like bloom popping out of that. Twice I saw the number 1917. But that was it. I had no idea what that meant. So anyway, on my side, you know, I was in charge of homicide at our police department. So I was the commander of homicide branch for quite a while in our police department. And when I was there, we had 83% clearance rate, which at that time was remarkable. But that still means every year 17% of people get away with murder. So I figured that's what's going to happen here. I'm just not going to have enough, you're going to have enough evidence to close this case. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to put it on the shelf. And that's what we do at the police department. If you have a murder and you run all through all the evidence, there's nothing, you do what you call deactivate it, put it on the shelf. But just never forgotten, if new evidence come along, you can pull the shelf and reopen it. And I thought, well, I don't know if new evidence ever come along, but I had to put it on the shelf. I told myself, Bob, you've done everything you can do, just forget about it. Well, that sounds good. I still couldn't. I still thought about it constantly. I thought about it all the time. But anyway, a couple months later, it's my wife's my anniversary is coming up in April, and we wanted to go that to somewhere we neither one's ever been. So she called me one day at the office and said, "Hey, what do you think about New Orleans?" I said, "Well, that's like fun. New Orleans, you know, I've never been there. She never been there, so like fun." So we made plane reservations, hotel reservations in New Orleans. Now, the first 4 or 5 days we were there, we did a lot of history stuff. My wife's a real history buff. And believe me, you can't throw a rock in New Orleans or hit something historical. We went there, plantation after plantation, to Battlefield 1812, what have you. And at nighttime, we go down to the French Quarter and have some drinks and, you know, listen to bands and everything. And I know it's kind of interesting. When you go down, we'd go down to the French Quarter every evening. But there are a whole lot of really neat stores in the French Quarter, which are closed then, but open during the day. So anyway, the last day we were there, our plane didn't leave till the evening. So I told her, why don't we go winter shopping in the French Quarter? And she said, that's not a good idea. So we went basically looking. They have all kind of neat, really beautiful antique stores and, you know, memorabilia stores. And we went through all those. We finally got down to Royal Street. Royal Street this time in New Orleans was all art galleries. So we went to the art galleries, started looking. And some of them, who were big art galleries, and had some amazing paintings and beautiful stuff. Nothing I could afford, so on a policeman's salary, certainly. But so we started walking down the street, looking at our gallery. We get out the end of the street, there's a little small two-story gallery there. We walk in, and it had a big sign for modern art upstairs. My wife's a fan of modern art, I'm not. So I watched, she went upstairs, and I walked along the floor. And I'm walking along, looking, I don't recognize any of the paintings or any of the artists. So again, it's you know, I'm just walking along and just looking. And I get to the corner, there's a portrait on an easel in the corner. And I walk by and give it a glance. There's like a window glass wall. I turn around. It was the portrait of the hunchback woman. Let me tell you, I was a policeman for like 38 years, and I've been in a lot of scary, frightening situations, a lot of them. But in situations in the police department, yeah, you can get into frightening, scary situations, but you have training and experience on what to do and what to do in the situation. In this case, I didn't. I had no chance. I stopped. I was so flustered. I looked at it, and then I thought, no, Bob, no. That's impossible. This just looks like the painting. It's not the real painting. It's not the one you saw, but one looks close to it. But then, like I said, I can still close my eyes. So I closed my eyes, and I can still see every brush stroke. And I opened my eyes, and I knew that was a painting. Now, let me say something. This is too big a coincidence to be a coincidence. Police officers don't believe in coincidences anyway, because so very often we find you have a case where it's a major coincidence. It's usually someone trying to make something look like a coincidence. Now, it's not a real coincidence. They want you to think it was. But that didn't make any sense in this case. I mean, who would want to make this a coincidence? So I stood there. I'm staring at this painting. I didn't know what to do. I don't think I've ever been so frightened in my life. Because it was these things don't happen to real people. They happen in the movies. They happen on TV. Yeah, sure they do. But not in real life. So I started toying with the idea maybe I'm not really here. Maybe I'm in a nursing home or a hospital. I got wires hooked up. And I just thought this is just a delusion. I mean, I was desperate. There's got to be some explanation to this, but to see a painting in regression, to search for it all that time, and it just stumbled into my accident. Nah, that was too big. I had no idea. I just stood there and looked. Well, after about 4 or 5 minutes, a salesman walked over. He must have saw me looking at paintings along. He says, "I bet you're thinking how nice that look over your fireplace." I remember thinking to myself, "Yeah, I want a picture of a hunchback woman. I don't know my fireplace." But anyway, I said, you know, I don't recognize an artist. I said, who's the artist on this? He said, well, hey, come over here. I got a little short bio on him. So he took me over to his desk, and he brought this little piece of paper and had me a paragraph. The guy's name was J. Carroll Beckwith. And I thought, I started reading the bio, And all of a sudden, I started finding confirmations of what I'd seen. I started from there and wonder what that there was the painting of the Hunchback Woman. And interesting, he was born in 1852. He died in 1917. I remember my two self-hypnosis, the 1917. And I found that the artist had lived during the 19th century, that he had won awards. And one time when during the aggression, Dr. Griffith asked me where I was. The part where I was in the garden, went to see my wife playing the piano. And I told her again, before I knew I was going to say, I told her I was in France. And I found that he had spent some time in France. Now, for a moment, this is getting scarier, but I'm thinking, now, Bob, come on. You've seen this painting somewhere. You've seen the biography of the artist. That's all it is. That has to be what it is. Now, that's why you can recall these things. But now I felt good, because now I could take this case back off the shelf. I had a name. I could go back to Annapolis. I could start doing some research. I'll remember where I saw this painting and where I heard about Carol Beckwith. So anyway, I went back there. When I got back to Annapolis, I went to the public library and told her I was looking research on Carol Beckwith. The librarian's very helpful, but there was really nothing. She couldn't find hardly any. There were very, very few mentions of any books. He simply wasn't that famous. He was a painter from the, like I said, the late 1800s, early 1900s, who painted mostly portraits. But he never painted anything. He didn't have any masterpiece paintings, things anybody would recognize. He basically made a scraped out a living painting portraits. So the librarian told me, said, hey, look, I tell you what you need to do. Go up to the art museum up north side of Annapolis. They have a much more extensive library on artists. I said, okay. So I drove up there and went up to the library and told the librarian what I was researching. She found a little bit more than the public library did. But the bad thing was she kept finding more and more confirmations. And this was starting to get more and more unsettling. For example, I found that Beckwith died in the fall of the year. I told you I thought it was fall because it was brisk, but the trees started to leave. He died in October of 1917. And I told you when I went through the ceiling, I'd seen I was in a large city. Well, he died in New York City. Also said that he painted portraits but didn't like it, which is why I told Darth Griffin. But he painted them because he needed money. Again, something that I had said to Darth Griffin. Also, it said that his paintings were quite often full of sun and bright color. And I remember the painting over the fireplace had a big sun in it and a lot of bright color. Now it's really getting frightening again. I thought, no, how can I know about it? She said, by the way, so I have a folder for the exhibition of his work that's held here in Annapolis. And boy, back then, it was like the most relieving feeling I ever heard. Thank God, I thought. I knew it. So she brought me the copy of the exhibition, the folder. Unfortunately, it was held in 1911. A major disappointment again. So I said, there hasn't been any exhibition since then? She said, no, he wasn't that famous. He simply wasn't that good or that famous. So now, you know, but interesting enough, on one of the little pieces of information she got from me about Beckwith, there's a footnote. It said, this information came from the diaries of J. Carol Beckwith, that are held at the National Academy of Design, New York City. So I knew what my next step had to be. This is bizarre. I've had 10 confirmations of something, and there hadn't been any painting exhibitions since 1911. How could I have known about this? So anyway, I called the National Academy of Design in New York and asked them if I could view the diaries. And they said, no, they're too fragile. We don't wear them out. But they said there have been microfilm made of them that you can get a copy of from the Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian. I thought, okay. So I went to the public library and ordered a copy of the microfilm. She said, it'll be about 2 weeks. I said, okay, good. So I went home and I listened to my tape again, the tape I had made. I wrote down everything that could be confirmed or not confirmed. I ended up having 28 things that I could confirm or not confirm. What I was looking for at this point wasn't more confirmations. I wasn't looking for that at all. What I was hoping to find was a negative factor. In other words, I said, we couldn't have children. My wife couldn't have children. If he had 34 kids, that means this whole thing is baloney. I mean, there's something goofy. There's not real. If he had kids and I say he didn't, then, you know, he did, then I know it's not real. This is not a real regression to a real past life. This is something else. God knows what, but it's not real. Or, for example, I saw him drinking wine. If he's a teetotaler or didn't drink wine, again, I got it. So I thought maybe if I get his diaries, then that would answer that. I'd find some denying factor, something to prove this wasn't real. So anyway, about 2 weeks later, I get a call, and they said, the Maximum's here. So I went down, I got him. I found out that Beckwith was a very avid diary keeper. He started at age 19, made his last entry the night before he died in October of 1917. There were 17,000 pages on his microfilm.
We're going to pick up with part two, and that 17,000-page diary that he continues to research and connect dots with and finds out some fascinating information with some celebrities involved in Carol Beckwith's history. Mark Twain, he mentions him, and Oscar Wilde. You'll have to listen to the interview for that or read the book. The books are available on Amazon, Looking for Carol Beckwith, and the other one, the follow-up, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, the True Story of a Police Detective's Reincarnation. I'll put links in the description, and you can follow up. I also have some information on my blog at Talking to Nightlights on WordPress. Be sure to follow up with part two, and thanks for listening.